Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Nothing spoils the mood at an economic summit faster, I'd imagine, than talk of nuclear weapons. Iran dominated the news out of Pittsburgh today, which leaves the G20 with two problems. One, how to fix the global economy. And two, how to punish a country already hip deep in economic sanctions. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields without increasing demands on natural resources. More at producemoreconservemore.com. And by Barron's, for more than 80 years providing investors ideas and insights on the markets. Barron's, see what others don't. Barron's.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 25th of September, and it is good to have you here. Iran's previously secret nuclear installation sucked all the air out of the room at the G20 summit in Pittsburgh today. President Obama, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, and French President Nicolas Sarkozy made an early morning appearance in front of the microphones to tell us about it. They said Iran has until December to reveal all of its nuclear programs or face new sanctions. So here we go again. The international community trying to coax Iran into coming clean about its nuclear ambitions by threatening economic sanctions. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has more.
The United States first imposed economic sanctions against Iran in 1979, and the results are hard to quantify. This is Ray Takei, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Since 1979, Iran has had double-digit inflation and double-digit unemployment. So it's hard to say whether that's the result of international sanctions and international pressures, or is it Iranian mismanagement and inability to have a coherent economic program.
And many experts say the sanctions in place now are full of holes because countries continue to trade with Iran by sending goods through Dubai. Takei says Iran's economy is forecast to grow 2% this year. And he says truly effective sanctions wouldn't be too pleasant for the rest of us.
Well, if you want to push it to the ultimate level, you can impose an embargo on the country and prevent it from selling oil. It's hard to see that coming about. It's hard to see international community agreeing to it.
And even if countries did agree, Karim Sajjadpour says it may not have the desired effect. He's an Iran expert at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
The priority of the Iranian regime has never been the economic well-being of the Iranian people.
So he says there's not much likelihood that sanctions will force Iran to change course on the nuclear issue.
But what we may see is that these economic punitive measures may be able to play a role in facilitating some type of a major political reform in Iran.
Reform that Sajjadpour says is still bubbling under the surface just a few months after those massive protests over the legitimacy of the Iranian elections. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
For almost 25 years, the governments of the world's seven largest economies considered themselves the decision makers on the global economy. That club grew to eight when Russia was invited to join the party in 1997. But today, the White House announced that the G8, as it's known, has decided to expand its membership even further. From now on, they said, discussions will include all the members of the G20, not just the big mature economies, but major developing countries as well. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains the big shift in economic power.
Including such developing economies as China, India, and Brazil in the global decision-making process has been a sensitive subject. European nations fear they'll end up losing their influence. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner acknowledged that during a news conference.
What we're trying to do is to bridge this difference between a number of nations in Europe that are going to, of course, have to adjust over time and have that shift occur to those countries who have been for a substantial period of time among the most rapidly growing countries in the world.
And that could mean a shift in power away from Europe. Fred Bergston heads the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He points out France, Germany, and Italy each get a chair at the table now, even though they also get a seat through the European Union.
But they still want to be represented on an individual country-by-country basis and so have multiple seats at the table. You just can't have it both ways.
Bergston says the G8 represents less than half the world economy, and he's convinced having more influential voices at the table will be more effective. David Shore agrees. He's with the Stanley Foundation, a foreign policy think tank.
you have small European countries with a larger vote than China. So it just had to be dealt with. You know, these various policy decision-making mechanisms have to catch up with the realities of the 21st century world.
But will so many different nations be able to agree? Shore says the group lacks the authority of, say, the United Nations or the International Monetary Fund.
The G20 is much less formal. It doesn't have set decision-making rules. It doesn't have a grounding in any permanent structure or any international legal agreement. And so, you know, this will be the thing to watch.
The foremost question, can they agree to this shift in power? I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Before we get on with things this afternoon, a note about the broadcast yesterday. We told you about a company called 21st Century Legal Services. In theory, it helps homeowners avoid foreclosure in exchange for big fees up front. All too often, though, those clients wound up either out a whole lot of money or losing their homes altogether. Well, as we were wrapping up our story yesterday morning, the FBI was raiding the offices of 21st Century and some related companies. We called and asked, but the FBI declined to say any more about what they were doing. Those of you who fly regularly will relate to this next story. All those fees you're paying, the $15 to check a bag, the $20 for an aisle seat, you know the ones. The Department of Transportation said today that those fees have become a major revenue stream for the airlines. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
Airfares may be down, but in the first half of this year, we shelled out nearly $4 billion in airline fees. It seems the only thing that comes with your ticket these days is a seatbelt.
A lot has to do with the nature of the business. You've got internet fare transparency, and people always click on the lowest price.
Aviation analyst Richard Abilafia says to keep fares low, airlines are basically unbundling the ticket price. Fees just mean customers buy the services they want a la carte.
Right now, all of these fees sound draconian and, frankly, evil. But you're looking at an airline that's trying to get its nose above the surface of the water. It's not like anybody's getting rich on these fees.
Airlines are expected to lose $11 billion this year. And fees are just about the only kind of revenue that's actually growing. That's got carriers looking to put a price on everything, from pillows to bathroom privileges. Richard Gritta teaches transportation finance at the University of Portland. He says the airline should be careful.
People begin to see, well, man, they just really are nickeling and diming me. There's the potential that they're going to alienate a lot of people.
Today, British Airways announced it will start charging passengers about $100 to book a seat before check-in. That means if you want to sit next to your friend or your spouse, you'll pay a fee. Abilafia says we'll probably start seeing a whole lot more of this.
Why not charge people to avoid a negative, like ask about our family non-separation plan?
Or you could pay to be separated from your family.
That's right.
Not sitting with your in-laws? You can't put a price on that. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Most of the prices on Wall Street today were going down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Depending on your point of view, this was either a week where we made great strides in reforming the global financial system or we backed away from those reforms gingerly. At the G20 summit, there was tough talk about new rules to come. In Washington, though, Congress and the Obama administration changed their minds about how much protection the Consumer Financial Protection Agency will offer. No more plain vanilla investment options. A whole bunch of companies not covered at all by those new rules. So here to help us do our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond is John Carney from ClusterStock.com and Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Hello again, you two.
Good to be here, Kai.
Thanks for having us.
We are going to start where our friend Felix Salmon deposited us in his blog earlier this week with a headline that said, "The End of Meaningful Financial Reform as We Know It." Barney Frank, chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, has revised his plan to overhaul the financial markets, backing away a little bit from some promised items. John, are we missing an opportunity here?
I think we've missed the opportunity, the period in which we could do meaningful reform because everybody was laser focused on Wall Street has passed.
Lee, let me play the diplomat that I used to be here for a second and ask you about the art of compromise. Obviously, neither side gets everything it wants, right? You're not going to have draconian new regulations, nor will things go back to the way they were. So isn't there some happy ground to be had?
Sure. I mean, you can make that argument. Barney Frank is compromising for the greater good of getting this through. But I have to say, I still find it really shocking. And even with the modifications, the reaction from the banking industry, that basically they just can't even conceive that this idea of a consumer financial protection agency is still on the table. They're horrified that it's even going to exist. When, way back when, this was the pillar of what was an enormous regulatory reform proposal. So, you know, not only are the compromises kind of surprising, but what happened to the rest of it? I mean, the new national bank supervisor, it's like one green shoot and the plan goes out the window.
Well, all right. Well, then where do we go from here if the green shoots are pushing us out the window, John?
If we can use this as an opportunity to say, look, we're not going to get through something quickly, but maybe we can get something better thought out. We haven't had a lot of time since the crisis to figure out exactly what went wrong, which means that it's hard to figure out exactly what regulations we need to put in place.
Dude, we've had a year. Is that not enough?
It's really not enough time because there's actually still a lot of fighting, both in academics and in journalists and among politicians, about what really is the core of our problems. And it's hard to get a good regulatory reform solution if you're not even sure really what the problem was.
But I have to say that the fact that they're rolling back the very simple requirement that banks offer plain vanilla products, the fact that that is now sort of coming off the table, I just don't think that bodes well for what else we can expect.
Yeah, John, how can it possibly be a bad thing to force banks to offer, you know, whatever nuclear-powered options they want to offer? How can plain vanilla be bad?
It's the smaller banks that actually don't want to have what they look at as their options limited. They're worried that if everybody has to offer the same kind of loans, they'll get swamped by Bank of America, by JP Morgan Chase, by Wells Fargo, that they won't be able to compete, because it turns out that that's actually what small banks do very well, which is adjust their lending to particular local circumstances.
Just to make sure I understand here, John, this plain vanilla thing, bad idea to begin with, right?
We're better off without it.
All right, one more gear change before I let you guys go. We're going to play a piece of tape, and then I'll tell you exactly what it's all about. Here it goes.
I would not look for any money to be coming back from the car companies to repay taxpayers.
They're a long way from out of the woods.
Well, I'm not so sure we're going to see that money back.
So we did a series of interviews this week about unwinding the bailouts, about getting money back from car companies and from Fannie and Freddie and from TARP and banks and all this stuff. And the general consensus was, we're never going to see that money again. Any surprise there, Lee?
It is surprising, yes. It should be surprising. It is surprising. Some of the banks have paid back their money, but the banks could have held on to some of that money and used it to lend. I mean, to some degree, AIG and the car companies, they need this to operate, and that's the whole point. But the notion that we're never going to get it back, that wasn't how it was sold.
Yeah, no, to say the least. John, thoughts?
I think particularly with AIG, Fannie and Freddie, that money's gone. In a sense, the hope that we could get it back is actually hurting us, because that's used as an excuse all the time to either give more money to companies or to allow them to pay outrageous amounts of money to their employees, to say, oh, well, we've got to do that. Otherwise, taxpayers will never get paid back with this money. I think once we've signed off on it saying, look, we know AIG can't pay us back. That company needs to be dissolved slowly and orderly over time. We need them to go away quietly into the night.
And just kiss that money goodbye, right?
Yes, that's gone.
John Carney from ClusterStock.com. Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks a lot.
The stock market gyrations over the past year have a lot of people thinking about their investment strategy. Get in, get out, stay put. There are a lot of ways to go. Commentator Lauren Silverman is all in.
Months ago, I hardly knew what the NASDAQ was. Today, I'm obsessed with the stock market. The financial crises made me want to learn how markets work. So I started practicing on stock market game websites. And I did pretty well. When analysts started raving about bargain stock deals, I couldn't deny my craving to trade in real life any longer. That's why I opened an online Charles Schwab account. Time to put my money where my mouse is. That is, the money not earmarked for tuition or resume writing workshops. See, I'm a senior at the University of Michigan. My friends vow never to put money in the stock market, and I'm reading Warren Buffett. I even left a party last Saturday before the keg ran dry because I wanted to check my portfolio. But traditional investing advice for 20-year-olds can't fill my appetite. I don't want to just glance through my closet and buy shares in clothing companies. I want to understand the fine print of 401ks and play around with asset allocation strategies. I want to secure my future, not drown in debt. So I'm constantly online reading the latest investment tips on message boards and learning from experienced experts, like my neighbor Steve. He's a professor at Haas Business School in Berkeley. I've started to glance over my dad's shoulders. He manages his money online, and I've quizzed my Uncle Richard on his latest investment schemes. But the truth is, my field research has only left me more confused. Steve tells me, with your age and risk tolerance, put at least 95% in the market. When I relay that advice to my dad, he shouts, "No, you're young, but whatever you do, don't risk your money in equities." Uncle Richard chimes in, "Maybe you should just buy T-bills." So I've stopped asking for advice altogether and decided to trust myself. That way, whatever I gain will really feel like mine, and whatever I lose, well, I'll just do what everyone else is doing and blame that on the recession.
Lauren Silverman is a senior at the University of Michigan, as she said. She's studying political science there. Her commentary was produced for us by Youth Radio. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, baseball tickets from the back of a van.
I've tried Ticketmaster, but they charge convenience fees and delivery fees, so it adds up. So it's a lot easier to buy them here.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dipped 42 points today, 0.4%, closed at 96.65. The NASDAQ fell 16.7%, ended things at 2,090. The S&P 500 lost 6.6%, finished at 1,044. For the week, the Dow dropped 1.6%. The NASDAQ powered down 2%. The S&P 500 chipped off 0.2% today. Airlines saw a big boost. Maybe it's all those fees we're paying that we told you about. American Airlines climbed 3.6%. Alaska rose 3%. Continental soared 4.8%. Brunswick, the company behind all those bowling alleys, rolled up a 15% today after an analyst upgrade. Bond prices gained. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.32%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. It's Yom Kippur. The Jewish observance begins at sundown on Sunday. Robert Zoellick, president of the World Bank, discusses the economic crisis in Washington. And it's about precaution and prevention. The World Health Organization marks World Rabies Day. Organizers say more than 55,000 people die of rabies each year. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. German Chancellor Angela Merkel ducked out of the G20 a little bit early today. It was an excused absence, though. She's got elections coming up back home. Europe's biggest economy goes to the polls on Sunday. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is on the line from London to tell us about it. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
You know, the German economy has been in a recession as bad as anybody else's. Angela Merkel was in charge when all of that happened. Will she escape any political blame for it?
She seems to have done already. I mean, her message to the German people during the campaign and since the crisis began has been, it wasn't our fault. It was the foreigners who are to blame. It was excesses in other countries that got us into trouble. And of course, she's talking about us there, the US and Britain, excessive bankers' bonuses and risk-taking. Consequently, she's not being blamed for any of the crisis.
If that's the case, then what is at stake for Germany and the German economy in this election?
Well, she seems almost certain to emerge as chancellor after the election. The political complexion of her government, though, is in doubt because she's far more popular than her conservative party, the Christian Democrats. She will have to govern in a coalition. She would dearly like to come out of this election in coalition with a smaller conservative party called the Free Democrats. They're more market-oriented. They would allow her to pursue some of the economic policies she's been unable to adopt over the past 4 years, tax cuts, spending cuts, slimming down the government bureaucracy, making the German economy more competitive. That's what she wants, and that's what's at stake.
The polls are closing, though. They are narrowing a bit. What are the odds that she's going to get her wish to be able to take the German economy and the political system there to the right a little bit?
Well, the polls have been on an absolute knife edge. I mean, this really, unusually for a German election, is really beginning to look quite exciting. It's still not clear whether this smaller conservative party, the Free Democrats, are going to get enough votes to form a real conservative coalition with Merkel, or whether she's going to wind up once again having to form a government with this left-of-centre party.
There's been a lot of talk about the Germans wanting to diversify their economy, get away from manufacturing and exports. Is this election going to change any of that?
Yes, possibly, because if Merkel does wind up in the embrace, the unwanted embrace of the left-of-centre party, the SPD, that is very likely to paralyse politics in Germany and certainly prevent Merkel from pursuing the kind of reforms that she thinks will get Germany into better shape, so it is less reliant on exports and less vulnerable to these downturns in international trade.
Stephen Beard at the Marketplace European Desk in London. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
There are some advantages to living in a place like Los Angeles, a city with a fully developed car culture. Parking is usually not too difficult to find. Once you figure out the freeway system, it's pretty easy to get around. And you can buy pretty much any food item you like from a truck. Fancy snow cones, Korean short rib tacos, starting next month, grilled cheese sandwiches, too. Customers go online to see where those trucks are going to be, and then they line up for a taste. As it happens, there's a baseball team in town that's trying to attract a similar following, as Nancy Fargali reports.
5-year-old Chris Rodriguez points to the street. His father, Rene, keeps checking his watch.
Well, I follow updates on Twitter. They update the locations where they're going to be. So as soon as I found out I was going to be here, I came here.
Rene and Chris stand on a street corner in the Sherman Oaks section of Los Angeles. It's around noon. Rene is on the lookout for the Dodger ticket truck, the first of its kind in Major League Baseball. Think of it as a box office on wheels. And Rene says the truck is an easier way to buy tickets. He doesn't have to drive to the stadium. That can take an hour from his neighborhood. And there are no service charges.
I've tried Ticketmaster, but they charge convenience fees and delivery fees, so it adds up. So it's a lot easier to buy them here.
The truck arrives about 20 minutes late, which in Los Angeles means it's pretty much on time. This truck is hard to miss. It's Dodger blue, and it has two flat-screen televisions mounted on one side, tuned to sports, of course.
Pull your face mask down. All right. What about the chest guard? It looks loose. Is it loose?
Rene is the first in line.
Come on in, tickets for tonight's game?
What section were you looking for?
As he figures out what to buy, other people take notice of the ticket signs. Beatrice Lorielli says she had no plans to go to the game today, but...
I was driving by and I saw the truck. I normally get them on the internet.
And that's exactly what Dennis Mannion wants. He's the chief operating officer of the Dodgers. He says the truck creates spur-of-the-moment sales. It offers deals like two-for-one tickets, which you can't find online.
You know, the truck is a way that you see it and you want to buy.
Overall, Major League Baseball expects a 5% decline in attendance this year. The Dodgers are averaging more than 45,000 a game, roughly 300 more than last year. Mannion credits the team's numbers to a focus on generating last-minute sales, and selling tickets away from the stadium helps.
We're finding a lot of success within a shorter window
10 days to a week outside of the game.
Later that evening, Rene Rodriguez is at the baseball game with his wife and two kids.
My kid's hitting next?
Nope.
Rene says these seats are the best he's had all year.
We're sitting in the reserve section, section one, right in the middle of the field. And I have a good view of everything here, so it's a very good deal.
Four tickets for a total of $31. He got a two-for-one deal from the truck, something he can cheer about. I'm Nancy Fregali for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note on the way to the weekend. In case it got by you, this is Friday, which means it's time for a break from the big news of the week. There won't be any healthcare or G20 in what's about to follow. Just Rico Galliano and Brendan Noonan doing that thing that they do, asking the Marketplace staff about the stories that didn't make the headlines.
New York reporter Jeremy Hobson, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, Brendan, since I'm in L.A., I'm going to give you a California story. It is from San Joaquin County. The sheriff's department has bought a vehicle that is so big they can't even drive it on the roads.
Wait, what do you mean?
They needed an emergency response vehicle, and it weighs so much that it's illegal in California to drive.
So somewhere in San Joaquin County, this vehicle is just driving in circles, trying to catch itself to give itself a ticket.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter, go.
Well, models are going to start coming with warning labels.
Explain.
The French are looking into a law that would require a warning label on a picture that had been modified to make the model look skinnier, you know, like in ads and magazines.
And why?
To combat anorexia.
Well, see, now that's admirable, but I think on certain magazines, wouldn't you have to put like a warning label on the entire front cover because it's all just like a ridiculous fantasy? It would be like, warning, there is no such thing as anti-aging cream.
Oh.
Warning, you cannot win him back.
But the horoscopes are true.
Amy Scott, bureau chief for New York City. What's your story?
Well, apparently relaxed cows are more productive.
Wow. Have you been reading The Far Side again?
No, this comes from Reuters, actually. New regulations in Norway apparently allow dairy cows to relax for up to half a day on soft, rubberized mattresses, and that's making them produce more milk.
That's amazing.
It's pretty amazing.
I have to have a Norwegian cow negotiate my next contract.
For a full helping of what Rico and Brendan have to offer, check out their podcast. It is called The Dinner Party Download. There is a link to it on our website. Of course, it's marketplace.org. And that is the radio program known as Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 42 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ fell 16 points, 0.7%. The S&P 500 dropped 6 points, 0.6%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yule. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, some mortgage deals really are too good to be true.
A company will pop up, rip off a few people, close their doors temporarily, or even just change their name.
We will see you back here Monday afternoon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.